stuff are the ones that are adults that don't know how your shit runs.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Morelia Python Radio, brought to you by MoreliaPythons.com, the Morelia Python Forum, the best one around, www.MoreliaPythons.com. Go over, check it out. Owen, it's just me and you today.
Yes.
We're talking Morelia.
Yeah, and
what's
we're
up?
On at the normal time. I mean,
yeah.
We haven't screwed up yet.
Yeah, right? Cool. So, yeah, I figured we're getting ready. I needed kind of some prep time for next week's show, which we have Dr. Richard Schein coming on. And if you don't know who
I know,
he
we
is,
actually we actually have to act professional and intelligent.
So we got to get it out of our system.
We need a week to prepare.
Yes. So it's good stuff. So yeah, tonight it's just going to be us. We're talking about a bunch of different topics, cool stuff happening. But before we get into that, how's it going? What's going on?
Rogue? Oh, well, the White Lips have vacated my house. They are now back with Chris. And you texted me, and you and I were talking yesterday, and you're like, hey, are you sad to see them go? And I'm like, I'm going to miss the black phase, you know. And then I'm like, fuck the gold, I hate them. So they were monsters. But it's good to kind of have everything where it should be and have a lot less adult snakes to deal with, and we're just down to the babies. And we did the third feeding trial for the Super Caramel clutch, and
okay.
I've never had a clutch work out this good. I think I only have four that are refusing food, and none of them, and only one of them are jaguars.
Oh, cool.
I know, isn't that weird? It's like, it's a jag clutch, of course he's going to have it. None, except for one. It's great. I love it. So I think I was talking to you, and I'm like thinking I might bring some of those guys out to Hamburg on the 14th if they're ready. I have to go to Columbus next week for some more training with work, but hopefully they'll be ready. You know, by the time I get back, we'll see what's going on.
Cool. Yeah, I had some. Some of the poison ivy babies have recently shed out. One, super bright. And then a lot
That's
of the other ones are dark.
The opposite direction you're trying to go in, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. There's a gene in the boa world, and it's called the IMG gene. IMG.
Go on.
Okay, so what happens is when the babies are born, they're born to a snake that is melanistic, high melanism, mm-hmm. but they're born normal. And as they age, the melanin comes in. However, when you take those melanin babies and you breed it to back to the parent, you get an all black snake.
Okay.
I know that Casper and Zach and, you know, these guys sort of pointed me in the direction of this boa gene, and after researching it, I kind of think that that's, I have a good feeling that that's what's going on. You can definitely see a difference in some of the clutch mates, but again, with not hatching out tons of IJs, it could just be wishful thinking on my part. You know, so I don't want to really put it out there that, you know, oh, this one is dark and this one is not. But
so you're pretty much telling me you're holding back the entire clutch, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think the only one that I would let some go to would be Casper, and that's the only way that I would let them go is we made
be overseas.
That we would trade. He has his
green
eye face. And
yeah.
I would have poison ivy babies. And, I mean, you know, wouldn't the name be fitting to say, you know, this is another thing that I wanted to talk about tonight. We're talking about morphs, and I'm curious, mm-hmm. are you the type of guy that would prefer melanistic IJ, or do you want something cool like the Vader gene? You know what I mean? And then if it's the super, then you have the dark.
Yeah,
if
you're one of those people.
So which guy are you?
See, I would like the science of it. If it's melanistic, call it melanistic. I mean, just don't dick around with it. But, you know, there's certain points like the panther. Isn't the panther just melanistic?
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, the fact is that it's already saddled with something like panther.
Yeah.
You just got to kind of roll with it. So, you know, it's... it's one of those things, but there's very few genes that you can really do that with. I mean, it's almost like you name the ones that get the names like AMAL and Exanic and Melanistic and Albino, things like that, and then you can rename the ones that are a little bit different but have traits of those. So, you know, it's like... it's almost like some morphs fit just with their description, like albino, but then you can mix it with albino tiger, albino zebra, albino this. But eventually, when albino goes into other morphs, you know, it becomes something completely different, like ghost, or sunglow, or something else. So it's like certain ones you can name, certain ones you can't. So,
well, I guess
know.
What I'm saying, there's two trains of thought like that I see in the herp community, and there's one where, you know, you're going to call this a super caramel, super zebra jag, you know, or do you call it one word, you know, like...
See, now my thing is that if it's a combo morph like that, it's almost easier just to call it what it is. It's a super caramel zebra jag, because I know it's long and stupid, but now I know what it is.
Yeah.
I know exactly what it is. If I sit
right
there and I call that the hippopotamus, no one's
yeah
really going to know what the hippopotamus is except for me. And that's
right
annoying. And people who are just getting into it are going to be like, I need to get this and hippos. You don't have to get hippos. You can make hippos with your own thing. Of course, those of you who know, the minute I create a new morph, the one that's never been seen on this planet before of any creature, it shall be named the hippopotamus. So
yeah,
I know there are several people praying to whatever deity they hold dear that I do not hatch anything new. Because, yeah, I'll make you all use it.
It seems in the carpet python world that we have a fascination with cats. I mean, we have jaguar,
the carpet python. Like jaguar,
tiger,
ocelot, tiger, panther.
We need a puma.
And then there was there was a leopard one, wasn't it? Wasn't that one of those failed ones? The problem is that a lot of people come out of the woodworks when they're fairly new to carpet python. I've seen it at least a few times where someone will get two baby carpets that look somewhat alike, and they'll be like, it must be a new morph. And I've seen it where they post it up on the forums or on the Facebook page or something. It's like, I'm going to call this the blah, blah, blah morph until hopefully it proves out. And then everyone
right
just goes, that is a striped red. Stop talking. And, you know,
right,
the guy eventually goes away. I think my favorite one was, this is the Dragon Claw gene, I'm going to call it. And it's like, what? So pretty sure that guy was like 12. So,
Dragon Claw gene, nice.
Yeah,
I think,
I'm like,
I guess.
Good name.
I guess,
good name,
I guess when
but
I,
that.
I guess when I look at it from the side of like breeding some of these morphs where it's going to have like four or five names in it, it's just easier for me to call it a something.
No, I want
than,
you to have to go through it and tell me everything that's in it. But then you get to things like the, all right, everybody brace yourself. You go to the world like the ball pythons.
Yeah.
Where they have certain morphs like the honeybee and the soul sucker and the champagne. And if you break it down, there are a lot of combination morphs in those. And you could sit there and tell everybody what's in that, but it's easier just to call it a champagne, and then everybody knows what makes a champagne.
Well, I'm gonna flex my ball python knowledge on you. A champagne is just a single gene. But you're talking about something like a killer bee. Or a
see, you're lame for knowing that.
Come on, man.
You've lost 12 Morelia points. Okay.
12 Morelia points.
12 Morelia points. Yes, it's a thing.
Well,
right.
Champagne is simple. I may be wrong.
I don't care.
Champagne is kind of like a Jag, where you get dead supers. I don't know if they're logistic. Anyway.
It was like spider.
Well, I think that the ball python world probably did that from a marketing standpoint.
They have two of them. They have spiders that end in leucistic dead ones, and they have champagnes that end up in leucistic dead ones.
Oh, there's a lot of them.
Oh, my God. Wow. See, I should really, like, look instead of just wandering past them.
You can learn a lot. I mean, say what you will about ball pythons and the ball python world and all that, but I'm telling you what, man, I learned a lot about genetics by just following what's going on with them. And, you know, you see these things, you know, I always call them the Dinker projects and such, but you can see, like, to me, genetics are genetics, man. You don't have, like, carpet python genetics and then ball python genetics. It's all the same.
You have snake genetics.
You know what I mean? An albino is an albino. Whether it's an albino sheep or whether it's an albino carpet python, it doesn't make a difference. It works the same.
Well, it's funny because if you look at it, I've said it a few times. There's a type of pink horse called an Ovaro that acts exactly like Jaguar, like completely. 25% of the foals from an Ovaro to Ovaro breeding are dead white ones.
Really?
Yeah, it's a horse.
Well, there you go.
I did a whole, when I was in college, I used every excuse I could possible to bring, like, my Jag Aurora to, like, the classroom. And I started running out of ideas. So my senior year, you had to do a big project, so I did it on lethal whites. And I found out that shit's prevalent in a lot of animals. So, heck yeah.
I mean, you know, like I said, I think that the way that we're kind of going in the carpet python world is cool, where it is what it is, and you know, it's kind of cool. But I can see where it would be easier just to call it a X.
Here's the thing: I don't think we're there yet. I think we're close, but I don't think we have enough variation to get to that point where we're going to have to do that.
Well,
yeah, it's almost I don't compare us to the ball python market. I compare us more to the retic market.
Yeah, I guess so. But with retic,
you have, you know, the tiger, the golden child, the super tiger, the titan or whatever. Then you have albinos of each. Then you have leucistics of each, or this of each, or albino phase two of each. And then you got the mixes where it's the tiger child. They don't really give names to it, but then when something completely different and new comes in, like lavender or calico or what the hell's going on, pied right now. Once that shows up, now pied's going to make its way through and everything's just going to become that. But they're never going to get so far out. They don't have enough of those crazy things to go all the way out to make needing a bunch of new names.
I don't know, man. An albino granite super caramel super zebra jag would be. That's a lot of names, man.
Touché, my friend. Touché.
You know.
And if it's like het, it's like all those het exanic, you're like, God damn it. So, you know.
That's a hell of a description in a what do you call it, in classified.
What's really going to need to be is that these combinations, they're going to need to start not looking close to their old counterparts. Like, say if an albino jag really didn't look like an albino jag, say it came out like just, you know, I don't know, purple, then you could potentially name it something completely different because it looks like something completely different. If it's just an albino jag, people are just going to call it what it is. So maybe with the further you get from these combinations, you start getting into these really weird colors and patterns that look nothing like the original thing that you bred it with. Then maybe you can start getting into the different combinations and different names.
Right.
Oh, exactly. People are just going to call it what it is.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So with that being said, what carpet morph are you looking forward to seeing this year? I mean, what's the most anticipated thing that you're like, man, I can't wait to see this thing hatch out? Anything?
Striped tiger carpet python. No, what I'm really looking forward to is Ollie's snows look absolutely gorgeous. And I know he hatched one out, what was it, last year? 2 years ago?
Last year.
Yeah, last year, and he hatched a few out this year. And the one that he hatched out this year has a lot more pattern than the other ones. And you can see the pink and the white, and it looks much cooler. It looks what a snow is, in my opinion. You know, it almost looks like a snow corn snake. So I can't wait to see what that one does when it gets a little bit older, because I think that is something that's always been kind of cool, is this pinkish-white carpet python. And I have people who aren't even into carpets who are texting me saying that they saw the pictures on the Reptile Report or wherever it is they saw them, and were like, these things look awesome. So those I'm excited to see. I think those are going to look really, really cool. What else? The other carpet morphs, you know, the basic combinations are always going to be kind of cool looking, but I'm also excited to see where the refinement of certain clutches and certain lines are going to start going now. I mean, we've seen the gamma zebras, but they're only going to start getting better and better and better and better and better. So I want to see those. I want to see the hypo brattle. I want to see what they do. I want to see the stonewash brattle. You know, mixing those stonewashes together is only going to get better, and then add a hypo into that, you might get hypo stonewashes. I mean, the hell is that going to look like? So that's going to be cool.
Badass, my friend. Badass.
There you go. I can just sit here and say imbricata, and you're salivating. I mean, you know.
Oh, man.
So, I mean, some of the morphs that are coming out there. I'm pretty interested in what albino's doing with the albino zebra jags, the albino zebras, the albino tigers. I think that are coming soon. They're going to be really cool looking. The next thing I want to see is those into the snow, you know, and, you know, can you imagine what a snow zebra jag would look like?
Wow, yeah, that'll be pretty damn cool.
That'll be kind of cool looking.
I'll tell you what, I do have that project, actually.
You have the ingredients. Yeah.
I have an albino jag and an exanic zebra, so.
There you go.
Years
and then the next thing I'm waiting for is ghosts. I mean, I want to see ghosts rip through everything that we got going on. Because, I mean, we've seen ghosts in Australia, but I want to see ghosts here. Because there are certain lines and bloods and breeders that I think could do phenomenal things with the morphs that we have yet to really kind of get prevalent out here. I mean, you know, imagine Gamma hasn't really done too much with the albino stuff. But can you imagine some of those gamma zebras with their yellow, mixing that yellow that would come out in some of the albinos? Are we going to get white with really bright freaking yellow? So.
Well, look at the, ocelot zebra jags that Bill hatched out.
Yeah.
I think of those. And imagine those albino, man.
That's what I want. Delete the black, put in white, give it red eyes, and give you that yellow, and it should be like, holy crap, that would be awesome looking. And then, you know, I want to see, I think Ghost would just be phenomenal in a lot of the stuff that we got going on here. I mean, did you imagine Ghost Tigers with those stripes?
I was just going to say.
I
was just going to say, like, you know, the, what do you call it? I would really like to see Ghost Tigers, but even besides that, I'd like to see a Super Caramel Tiger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fully striped.
Mm-hmm.
Fully striped.
I'm working on it.
Super Caramel Tiger.
I'm working
tiger.
On it. Ugh.
Dude, come on.
My female Caramel is got the stripes. She doesn't have the breast color, but she's got the stripes. And the male Super Caramel Jag that I'm pretty sure I'm keeping has barely any pattern, especially on his head. He has nothing on his head but this, like, trident kind of a deal. So, I know, he looks so, I mean, I thought he was so looking, and then he had his first shed. I'm like, Jesus Christ. It's one of those things where it's like, I can kind of see where the project's going in the next couple of years. And the shit part is, I gotta wait 3 years to do it. And it's like, so it's one of those things that's just going to be really, really cool. So.
I think of what that would look like. And, then when you would add albino to a tiger, there's a lot of things I want to see with tigers. Obviously, my collection is based around that. But I really think that a fully striped albino tiger is going to be crazy, man. That's just going to be wild. And I don't think that people would – I think that would – that's like a sleeper one to me. I think that people won't really think about that until they see it. And when they see, like – an adult albino, fully striped carpet python. Oh my God! It'll be wild. It'll be really cool.
Right.
With the Super Caramel, I was lucky. Lucky for me, unlucky for you. the female that I got from you, dude.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that she maybe able to go next. Well, maybe. I don't know. It's going to be close. But, you know, you breed. I'm going to try to breed her to a Caramel Jag and, you know, try to get some really nice. And Caramel Tiger Jags are kind of, they're the afterthought as far as I'm concerned. The Caramel Tiger is really what I would be
after. It's almost like, here's the thing. With the one that the Caramel I gave you, she might not express all that much striping, but the genetics are in there. So, I mean, I've had whatever you want to call them, tiger siblings, whatever the hell you want to say, that have thrown some of the best jags and tigers. I said it. Call you. So,
please don't send emails.
Send the emails. That would be info@moreliapythonradio.com. Owen can't access that email because he never learned how. So, guys, send them. So it's those genetics are in there, and it helps you kind of get the stripe and get you the ball back and get you the things you might want, even if it's just a tiger project or a jag project. My female Trinity, who's a tiger sibling, whatever you want to call it, is perfect. She's done great. And she always produces great-looking jags, great-looking tigers, great-looking everything.
Yeah, I think with the project with that girl in particular, she's really striped down on the lower half of her body. You know, but she does have, you know, I would not look at her and consider her a tiger per se. But to me, with the way that the tiger gene works, I don't even care if she's visually a tiger. I just care that the genetics are in there because I know that, you know, the possibilities of producing a few, you know, even if they're, you know, somewhat striped, if not fully striped, you know, would be there, and that's where, you know, I'd be taking the project. So even if it just had the stripe down the back and then you got the portholes along the side, you know, a lot of my citrus tigers are like that. So I don't know. It's a cool project. So, yeah, we saw the Exantic Granite. That was produced this year for the first time.
Yeah. And, have you seen albino granites yet? Or?
Yeah, they were produced last year. I can't remember who produced them, but I know he was over in Europe, I believe. And it might have been I don't want to say a name if I don't know exactly who it is, but I know that they were in Europe and they were produced. So very similar to zebra, you know. I'm curious to see what a granite and a tiger would do, you know.
You're really kind of bent on that, hoping that you can get like a granite-y kind of head with stripes of granite going down the back.
Oh, I don't know if that's going to work, but hey, man, I'm going to give it a try. You know, I really, that's in my dream camp, but, you know, it is what it is.
Right.
I want to see, but like you said earlier, I hope somewhere in this world outside of Australia, I hope that somebody has imbricata, and I hope that they're breeding them together. And
I love
I hope
how you're talking like you don't know. Like, I love how you're like, I hope beyond all hopes that
no, I really
someone
don't.
Didn't send me a news. Oh, shut up. Someone didn't send me a newsletter saying that they're going to be breeding these soon. Yeah, they're going to be here. I mean, whether it is through a zoo, whether it is through different stock, whether it is through the mysterious migration that they seem to have sometimes with Europe, one of those things. But the imbricata will show up. I mean, if certain things that were only in Australia can somehow get here, and certain things that were only here can somehow get to Australia, it's not a permanent wall. There are ways in and out, legal ways, that could get imbricata out, as well as certain other things. I mean, if zebras are in Australia now, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How did that happen? So
I don't know. They
there
just
has
popped
to
up.
Be some bullshit. So there has to be some legal way to get the things in and out, or perhaps maybe hoping to God Australia will somehow do something with legalized sales from breeder to breeder kind of deal. Who knows? So it shit could happen, but imbricata will eventually get out. It just needs to be a little bit more of a demand, just like how. Think about it this way. They just started that Owen Pelly project, correct?
Yeah, that was, a year ago, 2 years ago, maybe? Yeah.
And it is exactly like the Rough Scale project they started. Collecting, breeding, hanging out, doing whatever, right?
No, Yeah.
So it's only a matter of time. If I can have two Rough Scales in my basement in Jenkintown, Pennsylvania...
You're telling me that one day I'll have imbricata in mine.
Yes, I'm telling you right now.
I like
the
way you think.
Yeah, you will eventually have imbricata. I mean, that's just the way it goes. If we can thumb through a book from back when, you know, I know Nick was talking about like the Pythons of the World or the Barker's first book. If we can thumb through that book and we can see all these animals that are like the rarest of the rare and the craziest of the crazy and da-da-da-da-da and either have it in front of us or know someone who has it in front of them in the United States, nothing is beyond our reach. It's just going to take time.
Yeah. That's actually a pretty cool thought when you think about it that, you know,
I was walking in the Columbus Zoo and they have Maclots pythons and, Barnex and, you know, Savus. And I'm like, got it. It's like, going through my old pictures, I'm like, holy crap, I have everything in there. All right. So,
That's pretty wild. So, one of the other topics that we were going to talk about was, you know, holding back your stock. I think that one of the I guess there's different levels of if you're breeding. There's the breeder that does it to, you know, make some extra cash for rodents and to buy other snakes and not really doing it as a full-time gig, et cetera, et cetera. Then there's the next level, which would be what I would call semi-pro, which, you know, people make a pretty lucrative amount of money. However, they don't quit their day job. They still have a day job, but, you know, breeding snakes is kind of a side business type of thing. And then you have people that are full-time. I think I fall into that middle category. But I think one of the most important things that you have to do is hold back your stock. I think one of the things that I've learned over the past 3 years with breeding, number one, I want to try to get the smallest animals that I can possibly get so when they are babies, they acclimate to my surroundings. I think
I agree completely.
Yes. I think that the more animals that you have that hatch that you're, you know, whether it's your basement, your room upstairs, your facility, whatever the case may be. And you can't call your room upstairs a facility, and you can't call your basement.
I don't give a damn what that man says.
You know, you have to, you're going to have more success with those animals. I think you'll have less issues and problems because they're adapted to your environment. And
they're
I think
born
that's
and raised
kind of
with you.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it this way, I never had a problem with the babies that I've raised up from little ones. Of course, you have a few that you've lost along the way because that's the way it goes. You know, these aren't, you know, we're not collecting rocks here. They're going to die eventually. So whether it be one way or another. Now, the best success I've had is the ones that I've raised from hatchlings. And I'm talking the smaller, the better. My two best ones are my pair, Trinity and Talon. And I got them both as hatchlings. Trinity, before she even had her first shed, she should not have been sold to me. I was a dumbass and never should have bought her in hindsight, but it worked out okay. And they've produced some of the best animals over the years. And through them, I have my boy, Echo, who is now produced with my girl, Pixie. It's like, the better, the animals that work better, the animals that breed for it, the animals that survive, the animals that can take a little bit of a temp drop if your computer systems go haywire for a day are the ones that you raise from babies. They're also the ones that are the easiest to breed, as in, like, close your eyes, don't pay attention to them, throw them together and take them out a week later kind of babies. So it's that stuff. It's the ones that you get from other people, the adults that have been jumping around from collection to collection or have been raised by somebody who really didn't have breeding in mind, when you put them into your collection and you have to try to get them through winter, whether it be their first time going through a winter or a cool down, say you cool everything down and you bought a jungle carpet from somebody who only kept it as a pet and never took it below 83.
Yep.
That animal's going to be shocked as shit when the thing gets to 70.
Yeah.
And
what the
that,
hell?
That, exactly. And that stress and stuff is almost – that's why I almost say if you're going to buy – I always used to say if I'm going to buy animals, I buy animals in June or earlier because it gives them time to acclimate. If you buy – say I went out and bought an IJ adult in August – it's ready to cool down by the time it's out of quarantine. And don't get me wrong, there's some people who can say they can do that, but I don't feel comfortable with that, and I've never had good results. Either you don't get eggs or you get a sickness.
Yeah,
so.
I think I had a female IJ adult that I had, and I took her through breeding this year. I also picked up adults from Luke back in 2011, and both of those times, tried breeding them, couldn't get them to go. Obviously, the 2012 IJs that I picked, or I was able to produce them in 2012 to breed them and produce babies. But, you know, it was, I don't know. I just my experience has been is like, you know, your collection, your babies, the ones you produce. And I think that they, just like you just said, that they do the best. But I think we were talking about this before the show is like, you know, I think people are quick to go and sell off what they produced this year,
yeah,
and not hold back,
yeah,
and try to selectively breed or use it for another project, or I don't want to say phase out animals, but you know what I'm saying? Like it's almost like if you're going to if you're working with genetics as far as het stuff goes, and you know, eventually you're going to want to work with those visuals as a breeder, so that you're producing 100% hets rather than working with pos hets, or you know, maybe not hitting the odds the way you want it to be. Whereas that animal could go and become a pet, or could be somebody that just wants to sort of mess around with breeding a little bit, and maybe they don't want to invest a ton of money, so they're going to say, okay, well, this person has a zebra head albino or whatever, and I'm going to be able to pick it up for them at a fair price, and you know, I'm not able to invest the money per se as like an albino zebra, but if I get a jaghead albino, who knows, maybe I'll hit the odds and whatever. If I do, awesome. If I don't, no sleep lost. That's kind of like where I see those going. And then other times, I don't know, you hold them back if you've, I don't know about you, but I think secretly I'm a hoarder or something, but I can't seem to let go of the animals. You become attached to them, you know?
Yeah. Well, the objective is, listen, I say that nothing gets a name. If it gets a name here, it ends up staying. So they're all numbers, and then, I've had people come over. It's like, I'm going to call this one this one. If you do not call that thing anything, it has no name. So, it's one of those things where you should always be – the objective should always be to expand or improve upon your own collection. I mean, you always want to know you come up to do something. I mean, if you're breeding for a purpose, whether it be like, I'm trying to make really badass jungle carpet pythons to sell, okay. But you should be able to recognize what is one that you're going to want to keep because it's just too damn pretty to let go out there and someone else get all the, all your hard work. So, and it's one of those things where, eventually, like I said, your animals are going to die. So you want to have backups. You want to have the bloodline to continue, lineages to continue, different things to do. So you should always be looking to improve on your collection. If I'm working with caramels and I start producing super caramels, you better believe I'm going to keep a couple super caramels because that's the next logical step. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had granites downstairs and a granite male, and I have a jaghead granite. The second I produce a granite jaguar and that granite jaguar is old enough to breed, maybe I don't need the jaghead granite anymore, and I either give them to a friend or put them on a breeding loan or sell them. Because that would just be the improvement of the collection. And that's something you got to be looking out for. Now, I also understand that people get really attached to animals that you've raised from babies and stuff like that, so you kind of don't want to see them go. So it's perfectly fine with, retiring an animal and keeping it as a pet, but when it gets to a certain point where you're retiring, like, 20 animals and keeping them as pets, it's like you're going to run out of cage space. So that's I kind of like the idea. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, that's like that's a perfect opportunity to go ahead and pass along an animal. We'll call it going buddy style, and get somebody
just handing it.
Here you go.
It's also good with like maybe you do put it up for sale, but maybe you're really picky where it goes, or you find someone who's local, who's a friend of yours or who you know, and let them take it because they'll use it. Maybe they don't have that in their projects or maybe they're really missing it. They can give it a home for a couple of years and breed it then themselves.
Luckily for me, I have I have somebody to pass along them too.
You do?
Dear Owen.
Yeah.
How would you like
do
to
you
work
want this? Them? No. Son of a bitch, I'll take it. Yeah, it's like this. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't need a zebra jaguar. Did you sell the zebra jaguar yet? Oh, it's been 5 minutes. Answer the question. No. All right, I'll take it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. But cool stuff. Yeah, I would not stress that enough that you should hold on. So yeah, we were talking about this as far as like, you know, coming up with pricing. How do you come up with the price? And this is something that I often wonder, like, where does the price come out of? You know, you don't want to shoot too high because then it looks like you're crazy. You don't want to shoot too low and then it looks like, oh, well,
you piss everybody else off. Yeah.
It doesn't believe in the project. You know, there's like that perfect number to where you go. And, you know, when you're dealing with some of these rarer type of morphs or species or whatever the case may be, you're kind of like in this, you know, you're What do you do? How do you play this game? I know obviously you go and you talk to some of the people that are involved with the same project and try to get a feel for where they're going to go with it. But you know,
and
me,
you know,
it's real simple. I just keep it.
Yeah, I don't sell it. But you know, some of us do have to sell. But here's the other thing: is that you put it at a price that you can pretty much agree upon. It would be fair. Now the listed price has nothing to do with the price that you sell it for. I can list it for this much, and I can sell it for whatever I want, because that is my prerogative. But I do that behind closed doors, and I shut my damn mouth, and I make sure the person I'm selling to shuts their mouth. You know,
right.
If I'm trying to sell super caramels, and I'm trying to sell them at like $600-$700 a pop, and they're not moving, and I have a male that isn't the prettiest of males, but he's no by means an ugly male, and someone comes up and says $500 for it, and I take it, that's fine. That's
right.
Fine. But every time that animal went into public, it was listed for $600. Because
right.
That is what was agreed upon between myself and all the other breeders who were doing super caramels that year thought that that would be fair. And that is fine. If you are the kind of person who takes the stuff and takes it outside and puts it at a show for like $150 because you want to make table and buy yourself lunch and call it a day, you're going to not make a lot of friends. So that's, of course, your prerogative. If you don't feel like you need friends in this industry, I have had some people say that they really don't care if they make friends in the reptile industry. And to which I said, you do know you're going to need these people one day. You're going to need to, you know, ask them a favor, even buy something from them, or hope to God that they don't undercut your stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's just with everything else, there's a certain political dance you got to kind of have to do to play the game, or, you know, however you want to word it, you know,
yeah.
I'm kind of jealous of the guys that kind of like lay under the radar and kind of just do their thing and don't worry about what anybody says or does. Or,
oh, yeah.
I
don't care what I sell my animals for. That's between myself and the seller. But I also know what's fair, and I also know what I should be getting for those animals. So I'm also the kind, you've seen it where people come up and be like, I'll give you $200. And I'll be like, no. it's the funniest thing when you say that to those people. I mean, I love it every time, because I was selling that big jag you gave me. I had it listed for $400. And some guy came up and he's like, he's like, would you do three? I'm like, sure. And he pulls it out and he's playing with it and he goes, listen, I got $200 cash in my pocket. It's yours. And I go, no. And he looks at me with this look on his face of like shock and awe, like he just threw down cash and I'm telling him no. And I'm like, that is a $400 animal easy. And
right.
I don't need to sell it to you. I'm going to take it home in a month, throw it with one of my females, be back at the June show, and he will be a $700 animal because now he'll be a proven breeding male. So
right.
You said three. If it's not
right.
going to be three, he's going back in the box.
Right.
And then the dude handed over $300. Actually, the joy of it is that he handed over $400. I didn't realize that a couple of his hundreds were sticking together until I got home. Oops.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I didn't feel bad about it. So,
okay.
Yeah. But it's one of those things where, you know, it's okay to sell it for lower than what you're listing it for. You just got to make sure that's okay for you as a business standpoint or as a seller standpoint. Now, you also got to make sure that you're not going to do something stupid like sell an albino for $60 because no one's going to keep that quiet. and it's going to be all be over the place, and you have to stick up for it. So you have to have pretty much a basement in your own mind as well to tell people to, you know, get the hell out of my face. I'm not taking that. So
it's
this delicate, stupid little dance. Bill says I'm right.
Yeah.
But, you know, Bill might be a little upset because I accidentally sent him the wrong size T-shirt. So.
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't know who this is, but we have a caller.
Holy crap.
Yeah. Let's click it on and see who it is.
Do it.
Hey, caller with the 781 area code. Did you have a question or a comment? No. Okay.
Hello. Okay.
All right, then.
Good.
All right.
Good
we'll
comment.
Carry on.
Good,
maybe,
good
maybe,
thing. Yeah.
Maybe they're just listening and just
yeah,
and
we just totally just did that. All right, excellent. Wonderful point, caller.
That's the one thing that I wish that Blog Talk would do. Like, if you had people that were just in the queue, that they would separate them out, but they're all kind of on that, you know,
goddamn
if they have
talk.
A question.
Yeah,
but what are you going to do?
People kind of listening and interrupting it. Anyway, so.
So we're talking about that. So you know, holding back your stock is, I think, very important to producing. You know, you see some of these guys or girls that produce, you know, stellar offspring, and you know they've been doing it for a long time, and you know they've really taken the time to selectively breed, you know, for really nice animals, and that has to do with holding back and maybe not just jumping on the first person that wants to buy it for X amount, you know?
And it's not even that, it's not even that it takes years and years and years. Yes, the good lines have years involved, but you can get a good line going after 2-3 generations. It's just the way it is. And you got to be picky. You got to be picky about the ones you keep. You got to be picky about which ones you breed to what. And you got to know where you're going. You got to have the vision in your head of where you want to end up with it. If you're just throwing carpets in cages, hoping for offspring to sell at a show, you're not going to have as good of offspring as the guy down the road who's actually taking the time and picking it apart.
Hell,
Any idiot can throw 2 jungle carpet pythons in a cage. And I've said this at chamber shows all the damn time when people are like, well, I'm just going to buy those and breed them, and I'll sell them for the same thing you are. And I'm like, no, you won't. You won't get it. I'm telling you right now, because if you take those jungles and you breed them with no lineage, no background, no nothing, no name in carpet pythons for yourself, and throw those jungle carpets that are probably going to look not as good color-wise or even definition of pattern-wise out there. For $100, I can sell the same age carpet pythons from jungle carpets that I got from breeders around the world or around the country who I've raised up, who have excellent bright yellow, dark black, bold patterns. I can sell it for twice, if not 3 times, what you're selling yours for. And I've seen it happen.
Right.
So you have the right to be a picky son of a bitch when it comes to what you're doing and your animals. So do it. That's
so
how,
like,
these lines get established.
Sure.
Is, you know, if you want to breed tigers, don't settle for the kind of tiger with a good stripe down the back. Go do what Howard did and buy one of Kerry's complete striped tiger males and call it a day, because your tiger project's done at that point. You don't have to worry about building the stripe. It's there. But be willing to shovel out the money for it.
Yeah, I guess it just boils down to, to me, what I've learned, and I've said this a few times on the show, is that, you know, if I can do it, if it's possible, you know, I am not going to buy a pair of hets anymore. My goal would be to get a visual and a het. And the reason is when I go to breed that, I want to be able to produce hets and not poss hets. I don't want to be in the business of, you know, I don't even want to be messing around with that. I don't want to waste my time. To me, if it's poss het, it's a normal. Normal. You know, I don't want to mess around with that. You know, me personally, if I'm, you know, doing something that's breeding for me that I'm going to hold back, you know, maybe I'm going to hold back a couple females. I think they're poss het. This is what I'm going to try to do because, you know, that's the only thing that's available to me. Then, yeah, I'm going to try to go that route. But as far as, like, for, you know, when you're turning around and trying to sell animals. The posset thing, I just not my thing. You know what I mean? I don't want to have to deal with the it's just a chance that you're taking, and that's how it goes for the
right.
for the buyer. But I don't know. To me, I'd rather not mess around with it and whatnot. But I mean, you know, the hard thing with carpets is, I guess it's for all Morelia, but with carpets, is the variability is so wild. I think that for me personally, I gear my pairings and such to be at a point to where I can kind of keep, you know, I'm able to keep back the offspring that I produced for at least 6 months or so before I would even put them up for sale. Cause I want to see what's going on. I want to see how they, you know, how they grow. And I think, especially when you're dealing with something like jungles, unless you have certain project that, you know, people, for instance, with me, it might be easier for me to sell jungles when they're younger, because two of my jungle projects, number one is stripe. So I'm dealing with a pattern, you know, but even then they, you know, they might be looking for, you know, really bright striped jungle. You might not get that, but, you know, it's still going to be striped. So you can breed it to one of your wild, crazy looking jungles and maybe produce, you know, some stellar babies. But I guess with the flip side of that is I don't want the one that I should have kept back to sell, you know.
Right.
And then saying, God damn, I should have held on to that one. And then my other project is breeding towards melanistic jungle. So it would be much easier to see the black on a baby than it would. Is this gray going to turn yellow? You know what I mean? And then, God, I can't even imagine what it's like when you're breeding chondros, because, man, these guys, they have no idea.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's kind of like,
you don't know. It's red and yellow.
That's kind of that. But the other thing that we wanted to talk a bit about was breeding season being upon us, cutting eggs. You know, for me personally, what I do is if, you know, maternal incubation, I wait till they pip, then I kind of pull the clutch and let them kind of pop out on their own. I also have cut the clutch. And I usually do that once I see the one has pipped. There's kind of two trains of thought. One, if you cut them early, you're, you know, introducing bacteria and, you know, they're not meant to do that. And I think the mindset is that, I guess this happened way back in the day, that when people were trying to breed like albino Burmese pythons and such, they had animals not have an egg tooth and not be able to get out. And I guess if those guys were trying to get their money back.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen or heard that some will break the tooth off and stuff like that. I've had, I had a baby caramel hatch out, go back in the egg and drown. So, you know, it's one of those things where they're not the brightest of creatures sometimes, and Darwin has stepped in to eliminate them. So those are not suitable for breeding. But I've pipped and cut the eggs. I certainly don't cut as much as, say, retic breeders. I know that retic breeders will cut pretty much the snake almost completely out of the egg and give it, like, just a little, like, almost like a dish of eggshell left to sit in until it's happy, and then we'll move. But
right.
Where I've done with mine, like, the last couple clutches that I've hatched, the ones from last year, I didn't tip anybody. They all came out on their own because they all started pipping, and then I went to work. And by the time I came home, everybody had pipped out, and there was no reason to cut. They were all just already sticking out. With the caramel jags, the super caramel jags from this year, when I was in Alaska, my buddy Andrew was watching them, and they pipped, and he got nervous about not having to call me and say, like, oh, they all died. So he actually cut them like retic eggs and, you know, cut all the way around them so that they were sitting there. Because, like, ain't nobody drowning. I'm not calling him saying that the best-looking one is dead in the egg. So,
Yeah, that's some of those videos where you see those guys, man.
Oh my
just
god!
Kinda...
like baby just ripped out. Like,
yeah.
I'm like, wow, that was a violent hatching.
Woo, that's a little too wild for me, but you know, hey.
Poor little guys.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I have a pair of one of those really small. I guess they're like cuticle scissors, and I just put a little V in the top. I pinch it. And then you cut that pinch, and then just kind of open up that V, and you're good to go.
What you do is you pinch it, and then you kind of roll your fingers a little bit too, because that makes sure there are no veins, anything in that thing that you've pinched it. And then you just kind of cut it. It's a little snip. I have surgical scissors for when I was doing surgery in college. Was tough, so they're sharp as shit. And I'm always concerned. I'm going to be like, snip, and then like a headless baby's going to fall out of the egg. And I'll be like, oh, a little too deep. So, you know, I am concerned about that. But it's one of those things that you just kind of, like you said, just a little snip. And then if you're really concerned, peel back that V you just cut and cut it completely. So you got this little V-shaped, like almost a triangle-shaped window. And then just leave, because then they find that little window and they stick the little heads right out of it. So they're curious. So they're always going to want to go towards, you know, where the opening is. There have been a few babies that I've been concerned about and completely cut out after a day or two, but I find they hatch much faster if they pip and I leave them alone. Like if they pip on their own, they're out within a day. If I'm manually cutting them, it takes them a day or two to come out, because I think they're unsure of what's going on out there, so they don't really want to come out. So,
Yeah, I gotcha.
We're scary, so...
Well, I guess in the mind of a snake, we pretty much are. But
you're pretty goddamn scary. I mean, terrifying out there.
Yeah, but yeah, I guess another thing is like with the setting up of the babies. I mean, one of the things that I do is I just kind of I like to write down data.
Really? I'm shocked.
I weigh them. I set them up. I give them a weight. And that's how I'm hoping over the years I can start to see the difference between a maternally incubated baby as opposed to an artificial incubated baby. If it is really a size difference or if that's just total bullshit and, you know, it really has to do with the parents or, you know what I mean? I mean, the only way you're going to learn something like that is by taking down the data and then crunching the numbers and trying to find out.
You know what's weird is that this year the babies that hatched, the Super Caramels, I have one run to Super Caramel from last year who didn't really eat and is now eating, is rolling on fuzzies, like just started eating fuzzies, and she's eating the same size food that the hatchlings are eating from this year. She looks like she belongs with that clutch more than she does with her own clutch, who are almost a year old now.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. And they both have the same mother, different fathers. Huh.
Wow.
Both artificial incubation, both in the same damn incubator. So
here's a touchy subject with breeding.
Go on.
Animals, you know.
A touchy subject, you say? Let's hope we get letters. Go on.
You know, like, where do you think the breeder's responsibility is for culling those type of animals? And what I mean is if you have somebody that's – if you have you hatch out a snake and it's a poor feeder or it looks a little – you know, it just doesn't seem to acclimate to captivity, but you do get it to come around, do you feel that should be an animal that maybe should be culled because – you're going to go breed that and just keep reproducing those, you know, poor genetics?
No, I don't think so. Maybe not give it to the breeding stocks or sell it as a breeder, but there are different things it can do. You know, I have my two M-Pen, my pair of M-Pen Coastals are the worst feeders I've ever seen. The only reason the male is still here is because I haven't gotten him up to size enough to get past large mice. And I don't feel like selling them at this point. And they're just so annoying and terrible at feeding, terrible. But I'm keeping them because I want to breed them one day. That may be when I'm, 38, but, it's one of those things that if I can get there. But the ideas that they could not, I would have never, when I was thinking about selling the male, it was never to anybody who wanted to breed him. It was always to somebody who just wanted one as a pet, because I didn't want to pass on something that bad of feed-wise, or it was going to be to somebody who understood what he was, that he was a terrible feeder, and he wasn't ever going to be a good feeder, but that a male carpet python that eats jumbo mice could be a perfectly healthy, perfectly fine, perfectly good breeding male. They don't ever need to get any bigger. So that's what I was shooting for, and that's where I kind of let it all lie. But I pretty much figured just to keep him at this point. So, but that might change as I need cage space.
Well, I mean, I guess if you're looking at
I think as long as an animal is healthy and able to feed and able to do all the required things that a healthy snake should do, I don't think you really want to cull it. I mean, there's always a place for it, and it's always going to be used as a pet or something. But, you know, when it comes to breeding stock, you may not want to pass that on. But, you know, it's also, you sell it to somebody and he takes it to his place and sets it up differently, and all of a sudden it becomes a rip-roaring feeder that hasn't seen a rodent it wouldn't want to eat and completely turns around. He thinks they're funny like that. So don't ever just decide that, you know, I've had animals that have been the dumbest of feeders turn out to be some of the best sub-adult males or sub-adults or adults that eat. I mean, you know, Echo. When Echo was a baby, I couldn't get him to eat anything but mice and wouldn't take rats. I still have to give him one mouse before I give him his rat. So,
right.
Otherwise he won't eat. But I don't care, because he's a male, he's of size, and he's breeding. And that's all he needs to be. And he's not going to pass on that stupid of a feeding response to his offspring.
Right.
They're not all going to come out needing to be fed one mouse before they get fed a rat. That's all up to me and how I start them. So,
I guess what I look at it is that, like, okay, I'm gonna refer back to ball pythons for a second, because I genetic wise, so piebald ball pythons I'm going back from what I knew back in like 2009, 2010. So if this is wrong currently, or maybe they switched this or whatever, but I used to hear them breeders complain about the fact that piebalds were typically poor feeders, hard to get up to size. And that could be if you're, you know, ball python breeders typically turn around a female within, you know, a short amount of time from what Morelia
yeah.
guys would do. You know what I mean? And especially males too. You're talking like out of the clutch, 4 months old breeding, you know, some crazy stuff like that. And I guess if they're willing to do it, so be it. But anyway, the way I would look at it is that, okay, to me, part of selective breeding, and this is kind of where I'm going with this, is that if you're selective breeding, I think that at the time, most people were concerned with making piebalds. But you want the pain in the ass part of it is the fact that they don't feed. So,
right.
You know, you're always going to have this animal that, oh, my God, this thing doesn't feed. You're going to be frustrated with the project, and you're going to be pissed off and get frustrated, maybe get out of reptiles or breeding or all, you know what I mean? And to me, that doesn't really,
or
I don't know,
that's
not a win-win. With... So you find a gene, like I think, again, back then, I remember I sent a message into Reptile Radio talking about this, but, you know, I said spiders typically, like a spider ball python, typically feed pretty well. Like, their feeding response is pretty good. So, to
yeah.
me, I would think that you would just breed that to a spider, not because you want to make a spider piebald, but you're trying to outcross and trying to get that genetics of the good feeding response into that animal, you know, especially when you're dealing with recessive genes. Is it because it's, you know, you're seeing inbreeding depression where you just, you know, I think that's what's wrong with the granite. You know, all the problems you see associated with the granite carpet, just they bred the shit out of each other and just kept breeding it. You know,
sibling,
and, you know, I don't know. I think that as breeders, you know, we have a responsibility to look at animals and look at what we're breeding, how the color or the pattern, you know, but is this going to thrive in captivity? I mean, we're trying to produce animals that are going to thrive in captivity, and I think that's a huge responsibility of us as breeders, you know. I don't know.
Right.
What do you think? Really?
What?
I was waiting for you to have a response. You gave me dead air.
I got nothing for you. No. No, no,
oh,
no,
man.
No. Every once in a while, I got to let them pass. Otherwise, you get too complacent. So, well, you know, there's different things you can say to that. I mean, you can say that it's a morph could be to why there are some issues, but eventually you're correct. With the outcrossing, you're going to do away with all that. So, were pies really hard to feed in the beginning? Yes. Did granites have no eyeballs? Yes. So, you know, it's some of those things that have been corrected. And you can get away from that stuff, and that is with all in your breeding scope. I mean, I have had several baby snakes that I've decided were not healthy enough to continue. And at that point, I thought it was more of a mercy thing. And I've had several baby carpets that have never, ever started feeding on their own, who I eventually had to either force feed or keep going. And then around the time they turn a year old, they end up eating on their own, eat once or twice, and then they just end up dying.
Yeah.
It's just the way of it. You know, the reason that they have these clutches that are not one or two baby snakes is because not all of them are meant to live.
Yeah, I mean, in the wild, there's a good percentage that won't, you know.
In the wild, that if a clutch of 20, one will make it to adulthood or something like that. Everybody
yeah.
else is either dead, food for something else,
yeah,
or dies somewhere along the way. So
right.
it's, you know, it's one of those things where I will attempt to feed. I really don't like force feeding anymore. I used to be like, oh, I'll definitely do it when I was, you know, first starting out, but I don't really like force feeding. I use it as a last resort because I feel if you're just patient, eventually it comes around. Now, that's how you end up with babies like the one I got downstairs right now that was technically a year older than all of the other ones,
right.
but looks like she belongs with her half-siblings that were born this year.
Right.
So,
well, with that being said, do you think that individual snakes have individual you know, growth traits and, you know, do you think that my thought would be that, you know, they're all individual metabolisms and, you know, that kind
of
thing, you know, so to
course.
Think that
I mean,
you're right to think that, you know, you don't just give up on an animal. I'm not saying that at
no.
all, you know, just don't say like, I'm going to feed twice, yep, out.
Yeah. Well, you're completely correct. Individuals grow at different paces. I mean, you and I both have siblings from several clutches, and they are completely different sizes. And that just goes back to our different styles of keeping as well as the different animals' individuals.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
I mean, let me put it this way. I sold a Jag male to some kid up in, like, Connecticut. And he took it, and he sends me pictures every once in a while. And I have their sister. I have a full-blood sister kept here. And the male that he has is almost, like, double the size of the Jag that I kept here. And he didn't overfeed. I asked him about his feed stuff. He fed the same amount as I did. Other things like that,
right.
It's just his got bigger.
Well, do you think that is temperature related too? I mean, if you're keeping different temperatures, they're going to metabolize their food and,
yeah.
you know, everything's
yeah,
going to be a little
different. Different styles, different everything.
Sure.
Different environment. You're still classic nature versus nurture.
Yeah.
So, of course, things are a little different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff. You know, it's always weird. It's like, you know, like I said before, it's like you're either geared with your mind towards a breeder or you're geared with your mind towards a keeper. So that's going to lead me into my next topic. You know, the whole idea of caging and whatnot, and it seems to be, you know, I don't know if maybe it's just the people I associate with, but we talk a lot about caging. And it seems like very few that we're all relatively, you know, we're not quick to pull the trigger on what we want because, I don't know, maybe our OCD, everything has to match or, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, you see there was a post last week where I think Zach had posted up how he's going to keep his chondros and, you know, of course the everything ensued on, you know, that's the wrong way to do it and you shouldn't do it that way and da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, there's a lot of different trains of thought when it comes to keeping animals and keeping especially pythons in captivity. I guess my thought would be similar to what Zach said is that, you know, I think sometimes we think of reptiles as mammals and mammals and reptiles are totally different and our muscles are different and our bodies work differently. You know, one is ectothermic and one is endothermic and it's kind of like to compare the two really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But on the flip side, you know, we've had the conversation where we talk about, you know, racks versus caging and whatnot. I mean, and I guess people will probably be mad or I'm sure I'll get emails about that. But my thing is that I think racks are more geared towards a breeder. You know, I think you're able to be more efficient and ultimately keep the animals better with when you have that amount of animals that you're dealing with, as opposed to caging, where if you're dealing with, and it has to do with room too, I guess. So mm-hmm. I guess part of it has to do with maybe being, you know, selfish because you want to have a larger collection or you want to work with different projects.
Well, here's the thing. It depends on what you're doing. Say you're a commercial breeder who needs to breed as many babies as you can a year in order to make a profit, in order to sustain your livelihood and other things like that. You're going to want as much bang for your buck. You're going to have a limited amount of space and you're going to want as many cages as you can put comfortably into space. That screams rack system to me. You can have separate cages even run by separate different thermostats that are all perfectly sized. And, you know, some of those tubs, racks out there are huge. Like, you know, put you in them. Kind of huge, so you know it's not like you're torturing the animals in that. So
yeah, right.
An appropriate size rack, I think, would do well if you're a commercial breeder, and you don't have to necessarily do that. Say you're one of those people I know. Bob Clark uses cages for his retics. They're massive cages, but he uses cages for his retics. You can definitely get by with that. It depends on what your preference is. I just feel you only have a limited amount of space, I think racks would be the way to go if you're going to be a commercial breeder. Now, say you're somebody like me who just kind of does it on the side, wants to make money in order to pay for his hobby and maybe help out with something like the electric bill. I don't have to have racks. I have several racks because it's easier to house babies, juveniles, and subadults. Then I also have cages for my adults. I like the cages because I feel it gives them a little bit more room they don't really use or need, but I feel better about it. Also, it allows me to see them, and that's what I really like about it. I know there are racks with windows and stuff, but not as big as cages. So,
right.
You know, 6-1.
So,
it's whatever you really feel. There's some people who feel that racks are the way to go no matter what you're doing. Even if you're just a small person who's just, you know, diddling around, you can always have a rack.
So what do you think is in people that they feel the need to tell somebody else that they're right or wrong? It really drives
because
me kind of
everybody
nuts,
here, everybody who's involved with reptiles has to tell you exactly how they do it, exactly what their animal looks like, and how cool theirs is. Now, part of it comes from enthusiasm just to share what you're doing, and I totally am okay with that. That's just the way it goes. So, but if I look at it this way, I'll post up a super caramel in the pick of the week. And 9 times out of 10, somebody will post a picture of their own caramel or super caramel directly underneath it. As in, that's cool, look at mine. It's like, okay, congratulations. It wasn't really what we're doing here, but whatever. So it's one of those things. So what people seem to not understand is that a lot of times they're an expert amongst their friends and their people on reptiles. It's when you start getting into other reptile people that have been doing this for a while, sure, they're doing it differently than you. That doesn't mean that it's wrong. And you should respect that and say, cool, interesting, take what you can from that experience and then move forward. You don't necessarily say that's stupid. It's wrong. You know, if you called me tomorrow and said that you had all your snakes and racks, I'd be like, interesting. And I would definitely want to come over and see it and see how you did it. But if you're still getting eggs, who the hell am I to tell you you're getting it wrong? If everything's still happy and healthy, fine. The only time I would tell you that's a stupid idea is if you come to me and say my entire collection died. Then I'd be like, well, that was a dumb idea. So,
yeah, I mean, obviously you can go and you can look and you can see, or somebody can send you a pic and you can see that maybe that's not the greatest choice to do. I mean, you're not going to take a Burmese python and put it in a 4-foot cage. You know, I could see somebody.
Challenge accepted.
I could see somebody coming along and saying, "Eh, it's probably not best thing for the animal." You know.
No,
but
listen,
even look at what's his name, Barchek. He puts, Brian Barchek. He puts that big African rock, you know, in a rack,
yeah.
And he said that the animal does better when he puts it in a rack. You know, he puts
well,
it in a cage
see
and,
him,
didn't
and that's fine.
Good.
You know, Chris and I have talked about it a few times. Would it be better if they couldn't see us? Probably. You know, they don't want to see us. That's why people ask me why I don't put lights in my cages. My first answer was, I'm not a zoo. I don't need to see my animals. I know where they are. Plus, I'll reach in there and grab them. The second thing is that they don't want to see me, and they don't want
right.
to know that I can see them. They prefer that there was some dark corners to hide in. So, by all means, take your corners. So it's just the way it goes.
I think I'm just trying to cut through the bullshit of people. You know what I mean? It's fine.
There's a lot of bullshit.
if that's the thing that you dig, you know, if you like to put it in cages and check it out and set up natural
Are we about to say the same thing that we always say? If that's what you dig and that's what you like, more power to you. I mean, don't we say that about everything? Holy shit, is there some sort of pattern emerging here, people?
You know, but you would think that that people never do that. They never follow those
they
guidelines.
Do. Of course they do.
You know, they just kind of, I don't know. I don't know.
And who's to say, that you, like, you know, heaven forbid, all right, you get freaking racks. It works. Cool. Then maybe you decide you want to put some more in cages. That's fine. Hell, you know, you could technically, this shit has gotten done with 45-gallon tanks with mulch in them. And spotlights you use for bearded dragons. So who the fuck are you to say that just because you've got a cage with a radiant heat panel that it is better for the animal than a rack with a heat coming from underneath, a tank with a bulb and a light on it? You know, of course you can say, well, it's better temperature variance. But that's the computer system you're using. So I can plug a Ranko into every single one of those and get the same damn result. So it's what works best for you. There are 10 million goddamn ways to skin this cat, short of putting them outside in a dog kennel if you live in Florida. So, you know, don't sit there and say that your way is best for the animal. You have no fucking idea. Your way is what works for you, period.
Yeah.
Anybody says that to me, I'll smack them, I swear to God. Come to my table and say that shit to me.
Yeah, I'm going to do it. Next hamburger.
Do it. I'll put all a hamburger. I'll even yell as I say it.
We do have a caller this time, and it is Richard Simmons. Hey, Richard.
Hey, it's going, guys.
How you doing?
We're doing okay.
Hey, man, I'm doing good. It's 3 years of this stuff, and I finally had some success, so I'm happy.
Yeah, congrats, man. You hatched
out
cool clutch, man. Cool stuff.
Yeah, thanks. I was
awesome.
A bit surprised that the Jags were quite so busy with them coming from a 75% New Guinea Jag female.
Patterns crop up out of nowhere sometimes. It's weird.
Yeah. Yep, but it's pretty cool. But yeah, man, I also tried something different with the incubation this year. You know, we've looked at MI and we've seen that the females will fluctuate the temperature between about 86 and 96. So this year I had my incubator. I have a little small ovibator that I do this in with my Jag clutches only. And I actually fluctuated between 86 and 94. And thus far I've had 100% success, 100% hatch rate on one clutch, and the other clutch of 11 eggs has been there. They're all still good and due to hatch in about a week and a half.
Huh.
So
you know, there's a train of thought to think that when you know, a female is maternally incubating in a clutch of eggs, and there's such drastic swings in temperature that mm-hmm. that when those babies hatch out, that they're going to be tougher, you know, able to withstand.
Well, and the ones that aren't that tough are going to die.
Right. Right. So.
The survival of the fittest does happen to hatch when you become a zygote. It happen when you become a zygote. If you can't make it past that, then you just weren't fit to live.
Right.
Sorry.
There you go.
We can't
make it. Absolutely. You know, so that's pretty cool. What made you go down that path? What, you just experimenting, something you wanted to try, or
I wanted to try that this year because her reduced pattern, the general reduced pattern of New Guinea, is very, very similar to tigers or even jags, as people used to call them in the form against jags. And I was wondering if I was going to get some solid dorsal striping with a zebra-esque pattern down the side. And I got almost the opposite of that.
I got this
cool cobweb of pattern and then a very, very reduced head pattern. That's the only thing that looks like a jag on two of these caramel zebra jags that I hatched out.
Is this the quote-unquote Nova Guinea that came from somewhere? Okay.
Yeah, I got it from Dave Kelly, who got it directly from Paul via Nick.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, and then the next pairing is an ocelot, or a low expression ocelot jag that we got from a gentleman in Florida, and the jungle portion of her lineage traces back to Adam and Eve, and the coastal portion the guy didn't remember. So.
Okay.
Very interesting looking carpet. Reverse striped jag, and then the caramel zebra going over top of that. So.
Cool.
Could be something cool.
Very cool.
Now, have they shed out yet? They just hatched, right?
No, these guys just came out of the egg. The last one came out of the egg yesterday evening. And I did the cut thing because the first clutch, really don't want anybody drowning in the egg.
Yeah.
You know, you wait 3 years to finally get something going. You really don't want to see it go after you.
It's like you made it so close. You're like right at the touchdown, and it's like, oh, man.
Then I said, oh, look, my shoe is tiny. You fall over.
Yeah. Oh, totally understand that. Cool. Awesome.
Yeah, and I've got an inline clutch going on now with a red coastal female and an ornate jag from Yasser. So hopefully you're going to get some nice red jag hatching out this week.
Right.
So.
Now,
cool.
See, I noticed that you kind of like, this is something that me and you maybe do a little different. I was curious on your thoughts with this, is that I kind of just let them do their thing until they shed and then try to feed them. And it looked like you were like, you know, you took them outside. You weren't worried about them. Maybe I'm like a protective parent, you know what I mean?
Right.
From the outside, Eric. They're naturally supposed to be there.
I understand that. I get that. I'm not saying that.
Well, it's also the fact that I've got horrible lighting anywhere other than outside, and I haven't spent, you know, $6,000 on 15 white lamps and a little white box and a camera on a stand yet. So I take mine outside to get the best exposure of their color to be able to really get a look at what their pattern looks like. And like on the really dark one I've got in the clutch, if you look at it, it kind of looks like a, you know, just a lighter brown normal. But then you look at its eyes out in the sunshine, and they're bright glowing orange. And you go, okay, maybe not.
You can get a better light and not have to bring them outside. But, you know, that's just me.
I also like, you know, I work as a landscaper and a soccer referee now. I basically live outside.
Knowing my luck, I'd bring it outside, put it on a leash to take a picture, and some bird would, like, swoop and take it. And, you know, it's, like, the best-looking one. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there is that, but then you know you got to make sure your karma's in balance before you do that. O&M. You can't have water fights with small children.
I usually tell people to get bent when they want pictures of my animals outside because I live in a small community where people tend to freak out at the sight of a serpent outdoors. So
yeah,
there's several times where people are like, I really want to buy it, but can I see it outside in the sun? I go, of course you can. Buy it first, and then you can take it outside.
I live here in the Bible Belt, so everything is the serpent. It must be the devil. So, you know, hey. I get people crushing the baby corn snake thinking it's a friggin' rattlesnake. I'm like, really, people? Really? You're that dumb? Really?
Wow. So now you're in the same boat with us as far as the whole pricing thing goes. You know what I mean? I mean, you're kind of what's your thoughts on that?
That's why I've reached out to one of the other people that can produce these units this year, and they said that they'll feel comfortable discussing pricing once they've actually taxed the animals. And I said, okay, that's all well and good, but I'm kind of sitting on three of them. Now, granted, it's going to be a minimum 6 weeks before any of them would even be potentially ready to go anywhere because you got shedding and then eating and then, of course, you know, like I told Owen earlier today, got to sacrifice a giant hamster every day to the feeding gods and make sure that they're appeased before you offer food to the babies.
There you go. All right. Cool. So, yeah, it's a difficult thing coming up with the price. I think, you know, I'd be happy with them all $500, man. Just make it easier to sell. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, you know, hey, if that makes it easier to sell, that's fine. But the problem is, at some point, some jackass is going to go, well, you know what, I'll do them for two.
Yeah.
Fuck you.
Yeah. I never understood that about reptiles, man. I just don't get why the price drops every year.
My favorite thing is when you see somebody run back and forth between two breeders at a reptile show about comparing prices. And a lot of times it's really funny because I know the guy they're running to, just as the other guy knows me. So, like, I can see this person at my table going, well, would you do 300 for that? And I go, sure. And then run. I see them run to Jason Balin's table, and I can see them at Jason Balin's table, and they're talking. And then they come back, and they're like, about 250. I'm like, what the hell are you doing? So I'll normally call him out of it and be like, why, did Jason say 250? Well, I'm going to stay at 3. If you want, go ahead and buy it from Jason. So it just, yeah, okay. No, we're not playing tennis here. So.
It's like you see Balin looking back at you with that look on his face. He's like, yeah, motherfucker, he's yours now.
No, Balin will normally wad up a wet paper towel and throw it at me. So he's gotten pretty good aim over the years. So.
Listen,
at a reptile show and in reptiles in general, I'm going to take a sale and Jason's going to take a sale and Mo's going to take a sale and Howard's going to take a sale and everybody's going to take a sale. There's enough sales to go around. It's not like we're all going to fight and kill and beat up on each other and piss each other off. There's enough sales to go around. There are shows that I leave where I've sold 3 animals and Jason hasn't sold any. There are shows where he leaves and he sold 4 animals, I haven't sold any. And there are shows where we leave and we've both sold 5 animals. We're both in a damn good mood. It's just the way it goes. So I'm not going to fight over a customer and jeopardize the relationship I have with someone that I like a lot more than the customer. So
right.
Yeah. Shut up.
Actually, we've talked about having our own little mini carpet row out in Arizona once they get out there this fall because Todd Dyer will be out there. I'll be there. One of the Chris's from Headhunter is there. One of the guys from Australian Addictions is there. And, of course, you know, the troll of all trolls, V-Hoff, is there. So we're talking about trying to get it. We're trying to have V-Hoff use his local influence and get us all on one row there for the big reptile shows in Phoenix.
Cool. Don't forget Bill. He's out in Phoenix, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Bill Segal is San Antonio, Fort Worth, maybe. He's in Texas. He comes over occasionally. And also this fall, Michael Pennell says he might be making the trip out to one of the shows out there this fall, which would be really awesome. Get to see Michael again. I haven't seen him in a couple of years.
Gotcha.
One of my favorite guys in the hobby.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, he's an awesome dude. Yeah, that's right. I forgot. Bill is in Texas.
Yeah.
Bill is in Texas.
Yeah. But cool. So now what? So now what are you? What's your next? You got your pairings planned out for next year? You ready to rock with that? Are you all excited about this year?
I'm really excited about a couple things this next year. I've got two Pinnell females that are complete and total polar opposites. One is pinstriped in purple. One is a broken tri-stripe and looks like she could be a caramel. And they're both going to go with my possible super caramel 4 from Nick and also my 50% Sylvesterline caramel from Nick is also going to be paired with Thor next year from some hopefully really nice super caramels. The what's looking to prove out of the super caramel zebra is going to get paired with the same HCQ female, the New Guinea Jag again, and a striped coastal I have. I'm going to be running a low expression ocelot jag male from Bill to a low-expression ocelot jag female this next year, looking to get hopefully a nice ocelot female. I'll be doing the ornate jag over top of the red coastal female again, and I'll be doing the brettles that I got from Evan are hopefully going to go this year, and if not, you know, next year. And then I've got a hair to Turner jungle male from Matt Lacoste that I'm going to put over a VPI female and a 50% Lysik, 50% European lion jungle. So two pure jungle clutches next year. Fingers crossed for some really cool stuff out of that as well.
Cool. That sounds awesome. you're thinking ahead. I like it.
Yeah. And got to make the smart decisions on what you put together. You can't just throw shit together and say, well, look what I've got now. Okay, what the fuck
is it? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it makes that's what we were talking about earlier, making sure that, you put some thought into your pairings. And, so, cool stuff. All right, man. Well, congrats go ahead.
Definitely.
I was going to say, and hopefully this year I'm going to be able to get a bunch of pure and locality stuff. In the next few years, I'll be able to start throwing out some old school lines of jungles, and then in a few years beyond that, Brisbane's and diamonds and brettles and inland. I think I'm going to give the year off for Morse this year, and then focus on getting some of this pure stuff before the ball python people move in and screw everything up. there's rumblings in the underground that they're turning up and wanting morphs and multiple morphs, and we all know where that's going to go. And in 5 years, no one's going to be able to find a pure known lineage jungle other than like 6 people in the U.S. who have them. We're going to go, ha, look at us now. We got the ones you want.
Yep. See, that's why I played that game early on. You know, it's kind of like, I like everything. So I got the mix of all of it. So I'm happy. But yeah, wait till you get some inlands and some diamonds, man.
They're
next on my list.
Which one, inlands or diamonds, or both?
Can I say both? Yeah, both.
You can say both.
I can say both.
Dude,
but I'm saying both.
You know what? I got the one inland that I got from it's the Mog line one. I hope I'm saying that right. Anyway, it's just shed again, and I can't capture this on film. I have to get Zach to take the picture, but it's got
if
red
when
coming in.
You can take pictures way better than you. Oh,
yeah,
that's right, we do.
Yeah, but he's a busy guy. What do you want? Anyway, it's got red coming in on the tail, and dude, it's my God, it's so awesome. It's so bad.
I want some. Bring them quickly.
They're so
do it.
Cool.
Damn it.
Well, I got to grow up a little bit, but man,
well,
maybe when they're 5, you might be able to get something out of them.
Yeah. And then diamond pythons, I was talking with Dave, and I have crosses, I have crosses.
Yeah.
I have 88 percenters that are crosses, and yeah, man, there's something different about them. They're definitely cool, I remember Dave used to tell me that, and he'd be like, oh, yeah, these are just the badass pythons. And
right.
something different when you got them. I don't know. Maybe it's just in my head it's something different, but what cool snakes.
I'm going to be putting in that call to the Godfather of Diamonds later on this this fall once I get back out to Arizona and give Gary a call.
Oh, there you go. Good stuff.
Cool.
So.
Well, you guys have fun on the rest of the show. I'm going to get to cleaning a few cages and setting some things up for once these guys get shed and sexed and ready to be separated out of their little pile for a little while.
All right.
Awesome.
Good deal.
All right, guys. Have a good night.
All right, man. See ya.
Bye, fun.
All right. Yeah, it's cool to see when, you know, he's been trying at it for a couple years and finally have success and hatch out some cool stuff. So, awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But.
I'm excited that my freaking brettle is going to burst eggs soon. And, you know, it's always cool when you get the project to work out after you've been punching at it so hard. So.
Yeah, that's cool, man. With the brettles, do you think it's something that you can repeat again, or do you think it's just like first time luck? What? Oh, it's something
because this will technically be because they bred once with Mike Curtin, and he got a terrible, he didn't have very good, he got a lot of slugs. I think he had two eggs that were good.
Okay.
So, and then I brought him here, and I didn't drop him down low enough. They didn't even breed last year, which could be, you know, the same thing we were talking about, adult pythons being brought into a new thing, not really knowing how it works, and also me not getting cold enough. This year, I got him way cold and totally ignored them during the winter, and they locked up continuously, and I think I let you palpate her. She's pretty freaking thick, so, it's one of those things where it's like, holy crap, I just had to do what everybody told me to do, so.
Do you have, a little checklist in your, a little book or something in your toolkit that you check off when
all
you
up
read,
in my
read
brain.
Another species?
Chris and I were doing that the other day. We were, having a lunch meeting. We were talking about species we've bred, and I'm like, I've only ever bred one. He's like, what? The amount of babies you produced? I'm like, no, I'm sorry, that's right. I produced corn snakes, kink snakes, and coastal carpet python. He's like, holy shit. Yeah. I mean, I sit there, and there's a lot of this stuff is that because we've been listing off what needs to be paired, what's going next year, what's going the year after, and things like that. So it's one of those things that if you really kind of think about it, I haven't gone too far out, but I have a bunch of shit. So, right. Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty great. Do you ever see yourself getting into, some of the, Angolan pythons or anything like that?
Angolans looked kind of cool, and Ben, Dr. Ben did that at freaking ICAST, where he's like, look at it, it's bumpy. And I'm like, it is. He's like, it's only kind of like a ball python. And I go, it's earning some points here. Angolans would be kind of cool, but it's almost like we have the list. There's a long list and there's a short list, as with everybody. The short list obviously includes, inlands, diamonds, the eventual imbricata, a bunch of other stuff that's kind of along the basis of what we're already doing with scrubs and liasses. And then, of course, there's, ring pythons and a few other things. But nothing's ever off the map, really. I mean, why not?
Right.
Would you consider the weird things, or are you going to be hey, Owen, you should do these weird things so I don't have to?
Honestly, what my hope is that by the time I get a house and have enough room, you'll be breeding those things, so I'll be able to hand-pick
pairs. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, really, I would, people are probably going to throw eggs at me, but I'd really even keep a pair of ball pythons, I would.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even keep a morph or anything. I don't care. just to say that I've bred, I would look at it as the experience of breeding them. How are they different from carpets? How do they, that kind of thing, what was the experience like? Can you maternally incubate them because they don't twitch when they breed,
They just sit there.
Yeah. So I really dig, like, as far as that goes, I mean, for me, you know, I'm like an earth tone guy. So, like, even, like, if it was, like, a Mojave or a Lesser or something like that, you know, just to have the experience under my belt. But, yeah, absolutely. The Angolans, I didn't think I would like them. But you're right.
Now,
when we saw them with Ben, dude, damn things are hot.
Now would you go further and say, now I know you already use scrubs. Would you do something like White Lips?
I think I would if I had the room. But I don't think that I would until I was able to successfully breed what I have now. So to me, that's like the next level of species. See what I'm saying? So it's kind of like,
yeah,
all right, well, if I bred this and I can do that, let me try this. You know, I'd really like to get some ring pythons. They're kind of cool.
Gorgeous, and I miss mine so terribly.
Yeah.
That's a dumb mistake.
I don't know if I would get into, like, big snakes again. I would love, oh, man, I would really love to be able to say that I bred Burmese one time. You know, I had such a huge collection. I think of, like, the Sri Lankan python. There's a lot of cool stuff out there, man. But, it's like anything else. It comes down the room.
Exactly. And I sit here, and I'm like, what would be cool? Like, and it's almost like, you're exactly correct. And, you know, Chris and I ran through this stuff of what we might want to get into the future, and I pretty much said no more new projects until we get success with our other ones, damn it. So, and he's like, well, which ones? I'm like, I'm not going to peg you and say that you have to get success with the Moluccans, okay? That's just cruel. Get me white lips, okay? That's been done. Then we can talk about, you know, Timors or, you know, various other stuff. I mean, I like the rhino rat snakes. The problem is that this damn radio show that I co-host on every once in a while has ruined me when it comes to various other pythons. When I joined it, I only had coastal carpet pythons, and now I have everything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as far as, like, when you're going into colubrids, oh, man, there's a lot of cool stuff.
See, that's where you get to the rhino rats. You got, you know, we had success with bulls. I always had success with corns because you don't really need to look at them. I mean, you just... They poop a lot, but, you know.
I have a goal, a dream, or whatever, to have a setup that would be, like, in my living room or in my office or something like that, to where I would have, like, maybe 5 naturalistic setups, you know, like bioactive substrate, the whole deal, and I would have colubrids in them. I would have tangerine milk snakes. Mountain king snakes.
I like those too.
Okatee corn snakes, like really, really orange.
I don't understand your obsession with the Okatees. I mean,
I know it's crazy.
I really
isn't it?
Only because I've bred Okatee corn snakes. I've bred reverse Okatee corn snakes. I've taken Okatee corn snakes and crossed it with the snow and got brown babies and sold them for God knows what. So, you know,
it's so weird how your brain works, because, like, with those, I have no interest in morphs. None at all.
You just want
so
the
like, yeah, even with the tangerine, like, they have, like, a vanishing one, they have an albino, they have a hypo. Nope, I don't want any of that. I just want an orange and black snake. That's going to be badass. And then the same with, I'd like a hognose, you know what I mean? I think they're one of those snakes that if you had them and held them, you would be like, this is so badass, you know?
We had a Western at the lab, Western Hog, at the lab at Delva, and I so wanted to steal him. And we had one at the zoo, too, and I wanted to steal that one as well. I had a tangerine milk snake once. He was pretty cool. I could never find him a mate, but, you know,
right.
He came in a rescue at Chris's, ended up escaping and turning up in his bathroom a year later, and I just took him. So he was cool, but,
yeah,
you know, it was what it was.
I don't even know. Like, I think, I guess part of it, I would want to cock-size another one. That's the other one. I'd love that.
Yeah,
no,
bamboos, yeah, yeah.
Rat snakes to work with them. But even if I don't breed them, they would be just something that I would keep just as, like, like I said, naturalistic setup, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you saw the big tank that I have that I'm like, I could fit you and Zach in there and you guys could live in there comfortably for at least a day. I mean, you know, I have that, and my dream is when I get into my house is to have it in, like, the living room, naturalistic setup, plants and bunch of perches, and have a trio of chondros in it, my only trio of chondros, because I'm only allowed to have three.
Yeah,
and
right.
And that is all. Yeah.
Right.
So that I can only fit three in that cage, one boy, two girls. There you go. And I've left myself room for a whoops, and I have another girl, but that's fine. But inside that cage, it's a huge cage. I wanted to get all that naturalistic setup, have a bunch of hides, have a bunch of stuff, heat it the right way, and make it look really pretty, and have that, and just kind of have that as something that's awesome. I mean, my one friend used to make naturalistic setups for her geckos. She had mossy tail, leaf tails. Geckos. Yeah, Europlatus.
Right.
And she would do this naturalistic setup, and then she started mucking around with it because she's also kind of an artist too, and doing this really cool stuff so it looked kind of artsy as well as naturalistic, and it came off as something that's really pretty, and the geckos really enjoyed it. And she actually got a few copulations, but, you know, I think she ended up having to move and ended up letting go of her collection, but it was something that's really cool, and I've always kind of wanted that, where it's like this, almost looks like there's this tree growing in my middle of this tank in my living room, and a bunch of chondros, because chondros are very unassuming. You're going to sleep all day, and people aren't going to get too freaked out if there's this, you know, green snake sitting on a branch. It's not like I'm putting my Barnex in there or something like that, where you constantly hear them hitting the glass. So there's different stuff, and it would be cool. And I've helped this weekend. I helped Andrew set up a few active substrates for his monitors. That's all he does with his monitors. And then I helped Chris set up a few we didn't do active substrate, we just did, like, mulch substrate for the wet lips and the scrubs.
Okay.
So, and
yeah, like,
I think that's one of the ways to go here.
Yeah, I'd really love, and I guess that goes back to what we were saying earlier. I think there's this balance that you kind of have to do. You kind of have to balance. I think even if you're a breeder, even if you're doing this full time, you have to have those things that remind you what it's like to keep pet snakes. I really got inspired when we were coming back from Carpet Fest. We went to the zoo. Me and Zach stopped at the Philly Zoo, and I don't know, just seeing all the different species that are out there. I'm in the middle of reading that book, How Snakes Work, and it's really kind of fascinating, like learning about all the different species. You know, we're talking about putting together a trip to where we're going to do a herping trip and go up to Clyde Peeling's Reptiland. And one species that always fascinated me were rattlesnakes when I was younger. And they were in, and my father kept them, and, you know, to be able to see them and stare at them for hours on end, you know, but to be able to go out in the field and maybe come across one is pretty cool.
There is this thing about seeing an animal behind glass or behind over a wall or a moat at a zoo, and then seeing it absolutely, utterly free in the wild.
Yeah.
When I went up to Anchorage, the one thing that totally blew my mind is that, you know, they got bald eagles like we got pigeons. And, like, you come out of a mall and it's sitting there on a bench. And if you walked out of a store here in Philadelphia and saw a bald eagle sitting on a bench, I mean, there would be camera crews and people freaking out. The zoo would be called. You wouldn't know where the hell this thing came from. But they're like, it'll go away. It's going to grab that piece of trash and fly off. And it did. And it was just something that was every day. And it was weird and cool and something about it. And, I mean, also there's a different thing of, like, being able to touch that animal, that it's not from a zoo. It's not from a private collection. It's not from some dude trying to sell it at Hamburg. It's something that is wild. The second you put it down, it's going to go back to being a wild animal. And it's something that's cool about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
to get
a feel for what the environment is like, and to act, you know what I mean? You're there.
That's why,
you know?
That's why I want to go to Australia. It's like, people are like, oh, you're going to go to Australia, you know, hang around in Sydney. I'm like, no, I don't even want to see Sydney. I don't even want to be in the city, because I'm not going to go around there and be like, this is exactly like Carp. No, I want to be in the bush. I want to be freaking sweaty and cut up on stuff. I want a crocodile to possibly rip off my leg. You know, I want the full Aussie Outback experience, really.
Yeah, that's why my wife doesn't want to go with me on the trip. She wants to.
Exactly.
Because she knows what that trip entails.
We'll leave
know?
Her in Sydney and you and I will come out in the bush. So,
yeah.
But,
I think we would have a whole different appreciation for species that you keep if you actually get to see it in the wild. Can you imagine that? I mean, come on, man. How badass would that be? Pitching a
Bill
tent
says,
in the middle of the Outback for like 2 weeks, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Bill says that we should just go to Outback and order steaks and call it a day.
Not the same.
You know, I got free steaks at Outback once because I brought them a baby kangaroo.
Oh, really?
So,
oh, there you go.
Oh yeah, I was raising a baby kangaroo for the zoo. And
I'm not even
Outback.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I'm not even going to ask why you had a baby kangaroo.
Don't ever ask me how I got this thing. Don't ever ask me these things. I was raising a baby kangaroo for the zoo, and we were at this fair, and Outback was there cooking steaks, and they were selling them for like some ridiculous price. I came walking over with the roux, and the whole Outback staff took pictures with the baby kangaroo. And gave me and all the workers from the zoo a bunch of steaks. It was awesome. So,
oh, wow, there you go.
Baby kangaroos can get you anything.
Cool. Yeah, I don't know, man. That's some cool stuff. Like, you know, I guess you got a little taste of what me and you are into besides Morelia. I mean, Morelia is always going to be the top. Carpet pythons are always going to be my favorite, but... You know, there's other stuff out there, and I think you can learn more about the species you keep by learning about other species and how they work. That's why I keep going back to ball pythons and genetics and all that kind of stuff, because you get a better feel for – they have a bigger palate to work with. It's easier to understand. If you can cut through some of the bullshit, they're actually pretty cool animals. You know, when we were at the zoo, we were in the the rare primate house? You know, the very first house you walk up when you're walking up the path?
The small mammal house, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? You know how they have, like, the elephant?
Yeah, the small mammal house.
The elephant shrew.
I hate those things.
Where they have, like, you know, you can see underground and there's all these different paths.
Yeah, the naked mole rats and stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah. Tell me... You know, me and Zach were looking at it, and Zach says, you know, wouldn't it be badass if, you know, this was like a naturalistic setup for a ball python? And I'm like, yeah, man, that would be really cool, you know, because you get to see it like how it is in Africa. But, cool stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's a lot of ball python talk on this show. No wonder you keep
talking. That's enough. No more. I forbid it. But, you know, you and I can appreciate, that's the problem is that, you know, somebody tells me the joys of, you know, breeding redfoot tortoises. I'm like, I got a backyard. So that's the problem I have is that I can sit there and be like, you know, I could do that. That would be cool. So that's my thing is eventually people just end up like, I told Chris, he said, do you think Eric would want the Southerns? I'm like, put them in his hand and tell him how cool they are. He'll probably buy them on the spot. So, you know, unfortunately, I am the same exact way. And I was doing that with people at the last reptile show. I brought the smaller rough scale Vulcan. I brought him and everybody who I knew was into Morelia who came by my table. Like, here, hold the rough scale. And then I had people cursing at me and yelling as they're holding it and checking him out because he's just so damn cool. But damn you for putting him in my hands, you bastard. So, yeah, it was – I love that.
Noah's Ark Syndrome. It's Noah's Ark Syndrome.
Shut up. It's not.
Yeah, that's what it is. I mean, for me, that's what it really comes down to. You know, again, I've said it 1,000 times on the show, but my goal a long time ago was to keep and breed or just even keep all the different species of pythons. Like with scrubs, you know, I talked about it a couple of weeks ago, but I don't even care really if I breed it. I'm just happy if I keep tweed, you know what I mean? Like, to me, that's that's cool that I have, you know, hey, check it out. Here's my amethystine scrub python, you know? So, I don't know.
Something different.
I don't know if I could venture outside of the world of snakes, though. I think that's where my line actually is, because I know my limitations. And to me, maybe because I'm lazy or time management is, you know, with work and the job that I have, like to get involved in lizards or tortoises or stuff like that. I don't know, man. It's a lot of work. Too much work, you know. But
Iguanas, I can't, you know, I've seen too many horrific things from iguanas with the fact of, you know, how difficult they could be to keep. And also, you know, I've seen the pictures of people who got bit and injured by iguanas. No. And with that also kind of those monitors, you know, monitors right now are like, you know, small children. They're cool to play with, hang out with. Eventually they need to leave and go back to their own parents. Like my nephew, I will play with my nephew Hunter all damn day. The second the kid smells or is getting fussy, it goes back to my brother. So
exactly.
How that goes.
Yeah, I'm with you there. So, you know, I can appreciate somebody's enthusiasm for a species. I can dig what they're, you know, especially when they're going to talk to me about it. But that doesn't mean that you have to keep it all the time, you know. You know, you can be excited about what somebody's working with and not necessarily see, you know, have to run out and buy a bunch. But, you know, when you're growing up, trying to get your feel for what you like or what you don't like, you experiment with different things and work with different species, and, you know, eventually you find where you're supposed to be, what you like, what you're excited about, and that's what you should. But I don't know. So I guess we're 5 minutes away from closing. We're going to have a big announcement
Huge announcement.
Yeah.
A gigantic announcement. Some of the likes of which we've never heard or seen.
Yeah. It's going to be pretty cool, at least for us. And so we're going to be working with somebody, and should be cool stuff. Yeah. So stay tuned for that. We'll be discussing that later as we come along. I guess I'll go down my list and we'll just hop off. There's quite a few things that we have to hit on. Of course, always at the top is moreliapythons.com, the forum. Go over there and check it out. Also, you can go over on the forum, and if you already haven't given, I think it's still going on, Sean Christian, the guy who runs the forum, awesome guy. He also is doing a donation, doing donations for a friend of his that's trying to get a kidney transplant. So if you can, cruise on over there. The link is up there. It's also on Pick of the Week, but it probably went way down. I'll try to find it, see if I can bump it up to the top. But, you know, if you can give $5, by all means, go over there and hook him up. For all that Sean does for us, that's the least we can do for him. And let's see, what else do I got? Also, you can check out our website, moreliapythonradio.com. If you have questions or comments for us, you can email us at info@moreliapythonradio.com. If you have any negative comments, please direct them towards Owen@moreliapythonradio.com.
This is a newsflash. I have never, nor can I ever, check that email. So by all means, go right ahead.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to throw out another shout out for our buddy Chris Behoff. You know, he still has that discount. CB Reptiles is offering. It's a coupon code you can use to get 40% off FedEx retail rates through Ship Your Reptiles. The first shipment on your first shipment. The coupon code is CBR40, and it's brought to you by Chris Behoff and ShipYourReptiles.com. If you, by all means, if you're shipping, now that breeding season is coming to a close and babies are starting to hatch out and you're going to start to sell them, Ship Your Reptiles is the way to go. It's super simple, super easy, and they do a great job. That code is CBR40, and you can redeem it right now. Save 40%. What else? Don't forget Nick's, Nick Mutton. That is a sticky over at Pin Post, whatever you want to call it, over on Morelia Pick of the Week and Morelia Python Radio Facebook group. He's doing a research paper. He needs some data for twins. So he's asking you to collect some data for him. The sheet is over there on Morelia Pick of the Week. You can download it. You can also download it on MoreliaPythonRadio.com. Just fill it out and send it back to him. His email address is up there. And you know, it would be cool to be able to say that you took part in something like that. So
yeah, it's a major research paper. And
yeah,
those are important. If you're somebody who's going to college for science, do it. Learn how to get it done.
Yeah, heck yeah, it's pretty simple. I have the thing already hanging in my room that I filled out for One Clutch, but it's really, really, really simple info. And even if you don't have some of the info, any info will help him.
Any info is important.
Yeah. So
yep.
Do that for him. What else do I have? If you missed the show live, you can always download us on iTunes. Just look up Morelia Python Radio and we will be right there. As far as myself, ebmorelia.com. You can email me if you have any questions at eric@ebmorelia.com. I am 99.9% sure that I will be at Hamburg on
the not good enough
14th.
June 14th, yes.
June 14th. I'll be out there. I'm not going to be selling anything, but I'll be out there with Owen celebrating his birthday.
Damn right. God damn right.
Which I got to something that's pretty cool. And, of course, it's Morelia Python Radio related, but
my
I think
God,
you'll dig it.
Yes.
I think you'll dig it. So.
Sweet.
I don't know if I have anything else. Oh, one last thing. Don't forget Northeast Carpet Fest is behind us, but Northwest Carpet Fest is a couple
come
months
up
away.
Fast.
It is in July. Wait, hold on, 26th. July 26th. You can contact Heather. I want to say it's mysticreptiles@gmail.com for more information. You can check out the Carpet Python Facebook page, and I know there's a Northwest Carpet Python Facebook page. You can check that out as well for more details. That's all I got, Owen. Go ahead, take us out.
Sweet. What we got is you can go to rogue-reptiles to find out what's going on at Rogue. We updated. Also, if you're an iHerb person, I've been toiling around on iHerb, so we've updated Rogue's iHerb page.
No.
I looked at it, and I found out that I had not updated since I graduated from college. There are animals on there that have been gone for a while, and, you know, my bio was stupid. So, you know, I changed it. I fixed it. So we're starting to work a little bit more with that. So if you're on iHerb, you can definitely go there. Don't make fun of me. Just let it be. I think you do just go
move
to
along.
Facebook. Moving along. Nothing to see here. What you can also do is go on to Facebook, look up Rogue Reptiles. You can give us a like on Facebook. As with all the clutches that we have currently, any babies that go up for sale will go up for sale on Rogue's Facebook page first, then the website, and then they will be put on Kingsnake and Fauna. So if you are one of the people who likes us on Facebook, you get almost a week of seeing our ads before they, everybody else does, so it's a good way to jump on the babies. If you are interested in any of the babies that we have currently, we are running out of 2013, so we probably have about 7 left. And after the shows that are coming up, we're probably going to be down to 0 pretty quick. So if you were waiting to jump on a caramel, don't wait anymore. Jump now. After that, if you want to get on any list of the 2014 babies, let us know. Right now, currently, we have the Super Caramel babies have hatched. We have Red Tigers that are going to be hatching at the end of June. And then we have High Contrast Tiger Jaguars, is I think is what we're going to call those things. They'll hatch out in July. We're waiting on a few other females to drop, including our Brettles, a few other Coastals, maybe an IJ, who the hell knows. So if you're interested, let us know. We'll put you on the list. Other than that, that's all I got for us. Oh, right, one more thing. Hamburg, June 14th. It's the Hamburg Reptile Show, June 14th at Hamburg, Pennsylvania. It is my 28th birthday, so we're trying to get as many people as we can to come out, hang out with us. I'll bring cupcakes. I don't care. I know Jason Balin will be there. Howard Redding will be there. Mo might be there. Eric's going to be there. It's a good show. Good show to wander around, check out Morelia, and just come and hang out. So if you can get there, try to be there. It would be very cool. Other than that, what I will say is good night, and we will see everybody next week for some more Morelia Python Radio.